to Ukraine and wants the government to work for a peace proposal. Their calls have so far gone utterly unheard. Max Civili, Rome.
Venezuela is one of the farthest countries from Iran, but it's among the closest allies. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has had a busy schedule since he arrived in Iran on Friday. Here, he took a tour of one of Iran's major engineering companies, Mapna Group, where he was warmly welcomed by the Iranian tech firm.
It's a pleasure to have the Honorable Venezuelan President, Mr. Nicolas Maduro, at our company to present some of our capabilities, products, achievements, and our future plans to His Excellency.
Maduro has been in Tehran as part of an official trip that was slated to take 2 days, but later was announced to last for 4 days. Heading a politico-economic delegation, the Venezuelan official and his Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi, signed a 20-year cooperation agreement on Saturday to expand ties in the oil and petrochemical industries, military and economy.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Iran has been a key player in supplying fuel to energy-hungry Venezuela. Both sanctioned by the United States, Tehran and Caracas has boosted their partnership since 2020, especially in energy projects and oil swaps, helping the South American nation mitigate the impacts of Washington's embargoes. During Maduro's visit, the two sides also agreed to launch direct flights between Caracas and Tehran in order to promote tourism and trade between the two countries.
With shared concerns, shared interests, and a common rival, Tehran and Caracas are poised to push the envelope on their strategic alliance, viewing it as a counterforce to what they call Washington's coercive measures against both nations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thousands of South Koreans gathered in downtown Seoul to remember the tragic deaths of Shin Mi-sun and Shin Hyo-soon, ran over by a U.S. military vehicle on their way to their friend's birthday party on June 13, 2002. The children's family's lawyer hopes for change in U.S. relations and influence on Korea.
The massacre of two middle school students is a symbol of unequal South Korea-U.S. relations. In that regard, I think that the work of candlelight among our people to establish an equal relationship between South Korea and the United States in the future and move toward peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula remains unfinished.
Two U.S. soldiers were charged with negligent homicide, but acquitted in a U.S. military court amid anti-American candlelight protests.
The deaths of Mi-sun and Hyo-soon under the tracks of a U.S. military vehicle 20 years ago are but one episode of a problematic alliance relationship, from the Status of Forces Agreement to the cost of hosting 28,500 troops in South Korea. Alliance ties are a constant source of controversy and debate.
Some argue South Koreans view the presence of U.S. forces as an obstacle, preventing the country from exercising sovereignty.
It's not fit for the global era and very risky for South Korea to cling to a falling sun with the status of American hegemony declining so much. I hope we can establish more neutral diplomacy reflecting our national interests.
New President Yoon Suk-yeol seeks to strengthen the South Korea-U.S. alliance, a shift in policy that worries many South Koreans. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his visiting Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro have signed a 20-year document on comprehensive strategic cooperation, which mainly covers a wide range of areas, including petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural, and political fields. In a press briefing after the signing ceremony, President Raisi and his Venezuelan counterpart Maduro said the two countries should work together closely in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, as well as science and technology. They also hailed establishment of direct Tehran-Caracas flights as an opportunity to enhance relations and bring the two nations closer.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice, and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Earlier on Friday, in an interview with Iran's Spanish TV channel Hispan TV, Maduro said Venezuela and Iran are on the front line of shaping a world free of imperialism and dominant powers. Maduro also hailed Iran's courageous move to send fuel tankers to his energy-hungry nation, saying Tehran's delivery of oil to Caracas was a great help to the Venezuelan people. Heading a high-ranking political-economic delegation, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro arrived in Tehran on a two-day state visit at the invitation of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi. This is his second visit to Tehran. The first one took place about 6 years ago. Both Iran and Venezuela have managed to withstand the economic pressures from the United States and have closely cooperated to offset the impact of the illegal sanctions, especially in their energy sectors. Saman Kujrip, Tehran.
In the Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global forum by speaking against the prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation. But this time, it's about our beloved prophet. We'll take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by a quarter of 1% next month, most likely a half of 1% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then so if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money,
to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court.
It's a discussion that I have also with our US colleagues. We are on the same line to try to see what is possible to do. But you know that we try to promote the rule of law.
Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO.
ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A daily occurrence in Donetsk, a building going up in smoke. It was hit by Ukrainian shelling. This time it's an industrial warehouse, but targets like this are not usual.
Now, working as a journalist here, whenever I have nothing else planned, I simply follow the incoming here in Donetsk. And when I arrived at the fifth school that had been hit in as many days, the penny started to drop. And I asked my translator, a local woman with her two-year-old child herself, does the Ukrainian army intentionally shell schools? She replied as if it was the most normal thing in the world. Well, yes, they've been doing it for the last 8 years.
School 5, 13, 22, 33, 57, 106, 114, 116. There are dozens more. So why is Ukraine purposefully targeting schools? In 2014, when the shelling began, former Ukrainian president Petro Poroshenko made this famous speech.
Because we will have our jobs and they will not. We will have our pensions and they will not. We will have care for our children, people and retirees, and they will not. Our children will go to schools and kindergartens and theirs will hole up in the basements because they are not able to do a thing. This is exactly how we will win this war.
Six schools were hit only this week. They would like to create a humanitarian crisis here, so as many of us leave as possible. They think that this is their land and the Russian-speaking people are foreigners. They want us to leave to Russia. That's why they shell civilians here every day.
In 2014, School 57 was hit on the exact day the students returned for the school year. 10 people were killed.
Now, for obvious reasons, for the last 8 years, children here in Donetsk have learnt from home. The school around the corner was hit on the 30th of May this year. And on that day, children were expected or scheduled to come back to school for exams, which begs the question, are the Ukrainian army trying to maximise casualties here at these schools?
There are wounded and killed people every day. Children are dying too. My son is 4 years old. He hasn't seen peaceful life yet. He knows what war is, though. And he likes the soldiers who defend us. When my district was on the shelling, we were hiding in the corridor. He was afraid. He took the phone and started shouting into it, "Please, soldiers, come and help us." I think every mom here has got a similar story.
During 8 years of conflict, 117 children have been killed in the DPR. The Ukrainian government claims the city is still part of its country. The inescapable fact is that NATO is arming a government that is using its weapons to blow up, as it claims, its own schools and to target children. Perhaps the most shocking part of this story is that most of the world has turned a blind eye to the mountain of evidence of these crimes for 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The moment an exhibition turned into a series of violent assaults committed by the MKO, a cult-like organization that has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. Press TV's camera crew, reporting on an exhibition showcasing MKO bombings and assassinations, was attacked by angry supporters of the group.
Don't touch my camera. Don't touch my camera.
Go deep.
Don't touch my camera.
You go deep.
After being driven out of post-revolution Iran, the MKO based itself in Camp Ashraf in Iraq, where members were forced to pledge allegiance to its leader Massoud Rajavi and demonstrate that allegiance with cult-like behavior for women that meant divorcing their husbands and marrying him. Many families spent years on the fringes of the camp begging for their children to be released, but to no avail. The camp was later dismantled in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Until 2012, the MKO was on the U.S. terrorist list. It was also blacklisted by the EU until 2009. Since being removed, the new leader of the cult, Mariam Rajavi, has forged close relationships with Western officials.
What unfolded on the streets of Stockholm today was a shocking reminder that the EU has become a safe haven for the MKO, which attacks journalists like myself with little fear of retribution. The question now is, will there be an investigation? Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's advice on writers and speakers whose main job was to find fault with the Islamic Republic system instead of kindly helping the system and the nation to overcome difficulties and shortages. Today, you're going to hear the Imam's views in his testament to clarify the Islamic economic system in comparison with the capitalist and socialist economies. Stay tuned, please. The period of Imam Khomeini's struggles against the despotic Pahlavi regime coincided with the Cold War era, in which the two Western and Eastern blocs were in conflict in various arenas. The West, symbolized by the US, was an advocate of capitalism, and the East, led by the former Soviet Union, was the propagator of socialism. In those times, except the non-aligned nations, all nations were affiliated and surrogate of one of the blocks of powers. In Iran, too, many thinkers and political activists believed that there is no third way and one should join one of the dominant camps to survive and be successful. But Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, ruling out both dominant ideologies, presented the matchless model of the Islamic Republic system of government and Islamic economy. He writes in his testament, "Islam agrees neither with the oppressive, uncalculated capitalism, which deprives the oppressed masses, and rather condemns it seriously in the book, Quran, and the Sunnah, practice of the Prophet, and considers it opposite to social justice, nor with a regime like communism, Marxism, and Leninism, which are opposed to individual ownership and believe in partnership leading to a supportive dictatorship and despotism." Imam Khomeini, criticizing those who, out of unawareness and miscomprehension of Islam, try to justify wrong capitalist and socialist models and pave the way for opponents to attack Islam and the Islamic Republic, says, "Some people who miscomprehend and are unaware of the Islamic government and political issues ruling in Islam have pretended in their speech and writing that Islam, the unbounded supporter of capitalism and ownership, and with their false understanding of Islam, They have concealed the radiant image of Islam and opened the way for adversaries and enemies of Islam to assault Islam and to consider it a regime like the capitalist regime of the West, the US and Britain and other Western looters. And relying on the words and deeds of these ignorant, either out of bias and or stupidity, have embarked on opposing Islam without referring to real experts of Islam. Another group, due to miscomprehension and unawareness of Islam and its healthy economy, has also stood in the opposite side, and sometimes resorting to some verses of Quran or sentences of Nahjul Balagha, have introduced Islam favorable with deviant schools of Marx and the like of him, and have not paid attention to other verses and parts of Nahjul Balagha, and through their imperfect understanding have stood up and follow the communist religion and support on faith, dictatorship, and suppressive suffocation, which ignores human values, and a minority party behaves human masses like animals. Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, Islam is a moderate regime which, recognizing ownership and respecting it in a limited way, finds the way for real ownership and consumption, which, if it were accurately practiced, the wheels of healthy economy would rotate and social justice, which is the requisite for a healthy regime, would materialize. The founder of the Islamic Republic recommends the officials, especially those of the judiciary, not to be affected by media pressure and propaganda and preserve human principles of individual ownership. He writes, "My bequest to the parliament, the guardian council, the government, the president, and the judicial council is to be humble before the rules of Almighty God. And do not be affected by the hollow propaganda of the oppressive pillaging pole of capitalism and the atheist communist pole, and respect legitimate ownership and capitals with Islamic bounds. And I assure the nation so that capitals and constructive activities are put in practice to take the government and the country of self-sufficiency and light and heavy industries." Imam Khomeini advises the rich in society in this way. "I make bequests to the rich and those who have legitimate money to spend your justly accumulated wealth and embark on constructive activity in farms, villages, and factories, as this is a valuable worship per se. And I make bequests to all to strive for the welfare of deprived classes, since your benefit in this world and the hereafter is through attending to the deprived of society who have been in trouble throughout the period of the royal oppression and the Khans. And how good it is if the well-to-do classes voluntarily would provide homes and welfare for the inhabitants of slums. And be sure that the benefit of this world and the hereafter depends on it. And it is not fair at all that one is homeless while other one has apartments." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, continues in his testament, "My bequest to that group of clergymen and quasi-clergymen who are opposed to the Islamic Republic and its institutions with different motives and spend their time to overthrow it and help the conspiring opponents and political players and sometimes, according to what is said, render huge assistance to this end, with the exorbitant monies that they receive from godless capitalists is to apologize before God till the door of penitence is open and to be consonant with the destitute oppressed nation and support the Islamic Republic, which has been achieved through self-sacrifice of the nation. This will be to your good in the world and the hereafter, although I doubt that you will succeed to repent.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
While the U.S. is entangled in the Ukraine conflict, it is also pursuing another confrontational approach on the other side of the world, namely with China. At the Shangri-La Dialogue Security Summit, which ended in Singapore, China's defense minister hit back at the Pentagon chief Lloyd Austin, who accused Beijing of, quote, destabilizing military activity. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at what steps Beijing would take when it says that it had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Mike Billington joins us from the Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg, Virginia. Also joining us is Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who joins us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Mike Billington, I'll first start with you. When you have the U.S. Defense Minister meeting his counterpart from China face-to-face for the first time, he issues a warning pretty much, saying that Beijing must refrain from further destabilizing actions towards Taiwan, and that's a quote. Do you think that that's the right approach that the U.S. is using, in this case in point, in that summit which ended, from the U.S. Defense Minister?
No, I think it's actually worse than that. I think it's good that they met, but what Austin did was totally in keeping with the incredibly belligerent, provocative moves by the U.S. towards Russia and towards China. I will add something to what you quoted from Austin, which I think is far more ominous. He said at one point, and I'll read this. He said that we will continue to fulfill our commitments under the Taiwan Relations Act. That's normal. And that includes assisting Taiwan in maintaining a sufficient self-defense capability. That's also normal. That's part of the longstanding U.S. policy. But then he goes on and says, and it means maintaining our own capacity to resist any use of force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize the security or the social or economic system of the people of Taiwan. Now think of that. That is an open declaration refuting absolutely even the ambiguity policy of the U.S. and explicitly it confirms what President Biden said, which many people described as a gaffe, that we would militarily defend Taiwan in the case of a conflict. Which means that if the Chinese government chooses by force or whatever reason that they have to consolidate their sovereignty over their province of Taiwan under the One China, Two Systems policy, that the U.S. would launch a global war. Does he mean that? Is this meant to be simply provocative to get China to back down? It's very difficult to say, but the problem we're facing is that the U.S. and the British and the NATO forces have repeatedly stated that they intend to win this fight to prevent Russia and China and, by the way, most of the rest of the world, which does not support the sanctions on Russia and does not support the demonization of China, but in fact continue to support Russia and China and have economic relations with them. But does it mean that they will either submit to the now obviously no longer true unipolar world?
Sure.
The myth that the U.S. continues to be the only force in the world and that the so-called rules-based order, which simply means the rules we make after having won the Cold War, as they like to put it, rather than the international law established by all nations after World War II. The UN and international law has been basically dismissed by this policy.
All right, Richard Becker, what are we to make of U.S. foreign policy when it comes to China, when you have what our guest Mike Billington said there from Lloyd Austin, where he then comes out in the same forum saying another thing, such as reaffirming the importance of peace and stability across the strait, opposition to unilateral changes to the status quo, and calling on China to refrain from further destabilizing action towards Taiwan. To add and to question then what Mike Billington said, do you believe that the U.S., if China did make a move, would react and therefore start a war with China?
I think that we have to assume that very well could happen. And we should remember that February, just this past February, the end of February, marked the 50th anniversary of the Shanghai Communique. And the Shanghai Communique was issued in the Nixon presidency, with Kissinger taking the lead in this, and between the U.S. and the People's Republic of China, saying that parties on both sides of the strait recognize that there is one China. What we see happening now means that that has been completely overturned by the United States. That declaration that there is one China. In fact, the United States is engaging in the most provocative behavior, pouring weaponry and trainers, and we don't know how many U.S. troops and trainers and advisors there are now in Taiwan, but we have to assume that it's a great many, really the U.S. is treating the neocons who are running the foreign policy in Washington are treating Taiwan not as if it's part of China. They never fully did, but now it's very blatant that they're treating Taiwan as an independent country. And more importantly, though, than that, in fact, is that they don't really care about what happens to people in Taiwan. They don't care what happens to people in the Philippines or Okinawa or Japan. They are all part of what the Pentagon calls the first island chain. That is, they view them as bases. And it was just a few months ago that the head of the Indo-PAC, as they now call it, military command for the U.S., said that the first island chain countries must be prepared for war, not just war, but to be able to come back. After they are first attacked, they have to have redundancy in their weaponry so that they can continue fighting against China in the event of a war, which I think that everyone believes is very welcoming. So, I think that's an important point to make. The pretense in Washington that they care about the interests of any people has to be thrown out the window and replaced with reality, which is that this is a struggle to bring China down, to bring Russia and China down. And it's not my words. In 2017, the end of 2017, and ratified in early 2018, the latest national security strategy says that the war against terrorism has been replaced with major power competition or major power rivalry. And with the U.S. meaning that Russia and China are the targets and the context of the drive to make the U.S. the one and only superpower in the world. That's what the aim really is.
Well, let's hopefully clarify through you, Mike Billington, the deal that the U.S. has with these countries that it has military bases on. I know there's a status of forces agreement that it has with Japan. What is that exactly? From what I understand is that the U.S. can order the Japanese military, if it wants to take military action, for them to oblige, if that's a correct understanding of it. But what type of control does the U.S. have when it comes to these island nations or any country in that part of the world that they have bases in and their militaries?
Well, they have a serious problem in the Philippines from their view, because especially under the Duterte administration, but almost certainly also under the Marcos administration, that they will return to the kind of policy under Marcos's father, Ferdinand Marcos, who was one of the great nationalist leaders of Asia, who industrialized his country, built nuclear power plants, made the country self-sufficient in agriculture. And it was for that reason that they demonized him and ran a color revolution to have him deposed, after which the country deteriorated into being one of the most poorest and most oppressed countries in the region. So they're not sure they're going to have access to the military bases that they have, in a sense, still in the Philippines, within the Philippine bases. As to whether or not Japan will follow dictates, you might say, to join in such a war, Prime Minister Kishida gave the keynote at the Shangri-La Dialogue, where Austin was speaking, in which he echoed all of the U.S., NATO, British demonization of Russia, that he's fully joined in the attacks on Russia, and then said that that the China problem with Taiwan, that they're belligerent, they're aggressive, and that they're going to rebuild their military over the next 5 years. Now, I will add to that, though, a voice of caution. There is a upper house election in Japan early next month. there would not be another election for about 3 years. There are many, including friends of mine in Japan, former high-level officials who believe that Kishida is making these kinds of statements in full support of the outrageous war policies coming out of the U.S. and Britain, more for domestic purposes, and that following the election, when there won't be another election for about 3 years, that he will modify this and return more to the kind of policy Abe had of being friendly with Russia and doing business with China and maintaining a certain balance. I will also add that there is there's a fight back taking place around the world against this U.S. British unipolar world mentality. Jai Shankar, the foreign minister of India, just last week said, Eurocentrism is dead. We will no longer follow dictates. And of course, that includes the U.S. from the West. Meeting of the South American, the Nations of the Americas meeting in Los Angeles, in which the U.S. refused to invite three members because they considered them, you know, authoritarian dictatorships, led to the complete collapse of that event. Not only did Mexico and the Triangle countries not attend, they just boycotted it. Said, we're not going to tolerate your dictating who are members of the Latin American countries. But also Fernandez from Argentina, who did go, blasted this as an outrage. There are forces within the U.S., former high-level Army JAG officer, Colonel Richard Black, whose video warning that the U.S. mobilization for war against Russia, potentially nuclear war, with China obviously next in line,
right,
that this is madness, that this is creating a danger to humanity, and that this video has now 750,000 views. This is an interview I did with Colonel Black for the Schiller Institute. So there are reasons to be relatively optimistic if we fight hard now to inform, break through the information of war being waged by the Western media and the Western financial system, and bring these kinds of realities to the American people as well as the Europeans, that we can turn this situation away from the disaster it's heading for now. And partially that's because the hyperinflationary breakdown of the Western financial system is affecting everybody. Everybody now knows that the Western financial structure is in a state of total decay and collapse. Therefore, people have to think about what can we do to bring about a new paradigm of the sort that the Schiller Institute and Helga Zepp LaRouche have been fighting for with our conferences and our videos.
Well, Richard Becker, Mike Billington talked about the nuclear possibility between Russia and the States. There was a statement that came out of China that is pretty interesting. That was made by the defense minister to his counterpart, and he said something about the point where there's been significant progress that China has made in developing new arms, and this is in regards to its nuclear arsenal. So that was in itself somewhat eye-opening. But then he made this statement: I wonder if you have seen China's 70th anniversary National Day military parade and the new weapons and equipment available to the Chinese military. In which he then went on to say, but we don't engage in an arms race. So is that a subtle hint as to what the U.S. would face if it wanted to go on a military adventure with China?
Well, first of all, let me say, I must take exception with your other guest characterization of the Marcos regime. It was really the U.S. Marcos regime that was overthrown by an uprising of the people. And the U.S., back in 1986, and the U.S. managed to transition it to another subservient regime. As far as what's going on in regard to to speak of the of China's military buildup, what does anyone think that China would do in the face of a massive U.S. military buildup? I mean, this is a vast buildup throughout Asia surrounding China, in Taiwan. Japan still, I have to point out, Japan still has at least 84 military, U.S. military bases. Most of them are joint bases, or many of them are joint bases between the so-called Japan Self-Defense Forces and the U.S. That 84 doesn't even include Okinawa, which is covered, or 20% or so of the land or more is U.S. military bases in Okinawa. And then there's Korea. I mean, there's a vast deployment of military, of U.S. military already in place, and more coming, that the buildup is underway and it is continuing. So whenever we hear people say, and like the U.S. generals, they're alarmed by China developing new forms of weaponry. Really? I mean, that is so ludicrous when it comes out of the mouths of those who represent the biggest military contractor in the world by far, the biggest arms sales in the world, and the number one power in terms of developing new weapon systems, including modernizing, quote unquote, put the word in quotation marks, its nuclear arsenal. What's that for? I mean, that's promises nothing except death and destruction and possibly the annihilation of life on the planet. Sure. That's what we really see happening with the danger that we see coming from the U.S. aggression in against Russia. And Defense Secretary, and again, I would put that in quotation marks, Lloyd Austin, said just a few weeks ago, the aim of the U.S. is not supporting or protecting the Ukrainian people, it's to weaken Russia. And the U.S. is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian to do that.
Well, since we're quickly running out of time, I have to ask your reaction, Mike Billington, on what the U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said just last month. I mean, it really lays out the way that the U.S. feels about China, in which he says China is the most serious long-term threat to the world order, and that Beijing's vision would move us away from the universal values that have sustained so much of the world's progress. But I thought the impression that everybody had was that, and the U.S. included, was that China is technologically more advanced, like the 5G technology that it has. And yet Blinken's statement there is a diversion from that.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, what Blinken means by universal values are the values that allow the United States to wage regime change wars anywhere it wishes, over and over and over again. I agree with most of what Richard has been saying. I will just say that if you want to get a sense of how one of the first color revolutions, the way that Marcos was overthrown, I encourage you to go to the Executive Intelligence Review website and read my material on how George Shultz and Paul Wolfowitz ran that so-called People's Power Revolt, which was a model then for their efforts to destroy countries all over the world through color revolutions. As to blatant policy of Blinken following in line with the Obama policies, Obama-Biden policies for basically imposing regime change wars in places like Ukraine in 2014 and now openly running an effort to overthrow the regimes in Russia and China, that this is a policy which is only going to be reversed if we can bring the world together, including the U.S., to recognize that what is really threatening humanity right now is that the Western financial system is in a state of total collapse. We're holding a conference on the 18th and 19th, next weekend, on the theme that there will be no peace if the Western financial system is not put through bankruptcy reorganization. This is possible at this point because, as I said, everybody in the world is now aware of the devastating breakdown crisis, hyperinflationary breakdown crisis of that financial system, and that Russia and China have been working very closely together. Sergei Glazyev from Russia and Wang Wen from the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies at Renmin University in formulating a new financial policy for the world, not
exactly.
Just for themselves, not just trading in local currencies, but putting together an alternative which we can and must bring the United States through a popular mobilization to join with them. And our conference on the 18th and 19th,
well,
the Schiller Institute conference, will focus on that urgent necessity.
Sure. There is a lot of talk on this, Richard Becker, and we don't have that much time to talk about it, but there appears to be a very gigantic tectonic shift, if I may use that word, of a new world order, financially speaking, of which one of it is the fact that the U.S. dollar strength is going to decrease as we seeing the forces move forward, such as the way that Russia and Iran, for example, are experiencing the way that they evade sanctions. And of course, there's also the question of energy, where you have countries like Russia, Iran, and just the recent visit by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to Iran. You have these major oil powerhouses in one camp. Of course, you also can talk about Russia, China in that picture, where it all points to the U.S. Influence and power on the wane here. Are we looking at that to be the savior to prevent another war from happening? Because the war with China, I think, would be a totally different ballgame than the one that we're seeing with Ukraine.
Yeah, you know, I think that I just came back last night from Los Angeles from the People's Summit for Democracy, where well over 1,000 people from all over the hemisphere gathered as a counterpoint to the Organization of American States, a failed summit of the Americas. I mean, really a failure, a true humiliation for the United States, where the leaders of 20 countries, the heads of 20 states in the Americas did not show up in protest of the U.S. embargo, sanctions, blockade policy against Cuba, against Venezuela, and the exclusion of those two countries and the leadership of and the leaders of Nicaragua or any representation from Nicaragua. And so their summit was a failure. I mean, it was a complete failure, and the People's Summit was a true success. And I think it was a sign that the U.S. policy, that the U.S. power is slipping in different parts of the world. I think we have to also take into account, though, that when that happens, the imperialists may become more aggressive, more adventuristic, and I think that's something we have to be very concerned about. We have to build a people's movement on the ground in solidarity with each other across the Americas and across the world to call for an end to U.S. aggression and belligerence and the threat of new wars, even more destructive wars.
Okay, Mike Billington, final question along the same lines of what I asked Richard Becker. When you have so much energy focused on a number of countries that are not U.S. friendly, to say the least, let's just imagine if Russia actually takes over Ukraine by some sense and takes over their production of grain, you could see that then you have food in that picture also. Then is that something that would prevent the U.S. from its hegemonic aspirations or its expansionist policies as we see?
Well, again, the only way to reverse is for people to recognize that the driving force behind the U.S.-British-NATO push for war against Russia and against China, not Ukraine, it's not Taiwan. Baker is right that they haven't for the people in Ukraine or the people in Taiwan. The purpose is that the Western financial system is breaking down, and they see that Russia and China have posed an alternative, and their reaction is
all right. I'm sorry, I got to jump in, Mike Billington. We're just fresh out of time. I do apologize for that. Wish we had more time. Mike Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review, Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tagway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.